Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunluie.net.
Now we'll be talking to Ronan Gara just after 8 o'clock on Wednesday Night Rugby, but there is a very decent Carabao Cup quarter final about to kick off. The teams are in. Seamus Coleman captains Everton this evening. They have Godfrey, Keane, Mina, Decore, Gomez, Sigurdsson, Iwobi, Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin leading the line. As for Manchester United, it looks like the diamond in the midfield, split strikers up top. So it's Henderson, back four of Tuanzabi, Bailey, Maguire and Telles at left back. And then midfield diamond of Matic, Pogba, Van de Beek and Fernandes. And then up top, again, you're presuming split strikers, but we'll see once kickoff happens. Greenwood and Cavani starts as well for Manchester United this evening. So earlier on, I spoke to editor of United We Stand, Andy Mitten. It has been a turbulent time for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer of late. And Andy joined us just before coming on air from a very cold Goodison Park.
I've just come from Liverpool City Centre and it's freezing and it's raining and I'm drenched and I love watching football in December and feel very lucky to be able to go inside this wonderful stadium.
Oh, beautiful. Radio listeners can't see, obviously, but he's given us a beautiful shot there of Goodison, which is one of the great traditional grounds still. I mean, if you look at footage of the 1966 World Cup, you can recognise it instantly.
It's one of my favourite grounds. I've often written that it's the Wrigley Field of English football. It's still got areas of wooden seats, and it's a beautiful stadium. And I understand the reasons why Everton need to move to a super dome on the banks of the River Mersey rather than in this working class area just across Stanley Park from Anfield. But I love Goodison Park and I love coming here and looking forward to the game this evening between Everton and Manchester United.
Mm. The domes never quite have the same atmosphere.
They don't. And I'm a little bit of a traditionalist. I can see why they have to move. There are no or extremely limited executive facilities here, which bring lots of money in. It's very difficult to park your car here. Although when you do, there's no shortage of people asking for a few quid to mind your car for you. Public transport could be far better. And it's a cramped site. It's one of those old English football grounds built in the Victorian era among the community which it serves. And that's what I like about it. There's only going to be 2,000 fans here tonight, but I just saw somebody walk out of the front door and walk towards the ground. And I love that. And some of the Superdomes, you might get a better view. You certainly pay more for the facilities inside them, but I'm torn on it. I would have loved Everton to be able to redevelop Goodison, like Liverpool have done with Anfield, and Liverpool have done a very good job of it, expanding the capacity. But it's a much smaller site here and they're going to move. And I'm sure it'll be beautiful. I'm sure you'll get the televisual sunsets over the Mersey estuary with the city of Liverpool as a backdrop on the other side and the Liver building. But I'll miss Goodison and I'm sure Everton fans will too.
To remind ourselves of Manchester United's recent form, 3-1 defeat to PSG. The second half plucked the West Ham game out of the fire, then a 3-1 win. 3-2 defeat to Leipzig, the nil-all draw at Man City, a 3-2 win away to Sheffield United, and then 6-2 at the weekend. Post that Leipzig defeat and the Champions League exit heading into the Manchester derby, which was a so-so game, we don't need to revisit that in any great detail. There was a brewing sense of discord once again around Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He's put a degree of coolant on it with the last couple of games, but it, such as the expedited news cycles that we're all living in, he does seem to stumble in and out of these relatively quickly at the moment.
He does, and it's so accelerated, but that's not to say that it reflects reality. And I work for several outlets, and I have editors saying to me, can you write a piece now about whether Ollie's going to be sacked this weekend if he loses at Everton, for example, which came after the defeat in Istanbul last month? And I said, well, I'm telling you now that he's not going to be sacked. Yeah, but, you know, that's the general feeling. I'm saying, I'm telling you now with the sources I've got, which I trust with my life, that he's not going to lose his job this weekend, even if Manchester United lose 8-0. And then I write a balanced piece. And of course, there's concern when results are bad, such as that one in Istanbul or the one you mentioned in Leipzig. And it was a big disappointment when United didn't go through that Champions League group because it started it so well. But league form has been good since, probably better than it's been at any point this season. United are within touching distance of the top of a table, which none of the fans thought they'd win at the start of this season. And most don't. I certainly don't expect United to be Premier League champions come May or whenever this season ends up finishing. But the form has improved. Scoring goals, there's a big win against Leeds. The problem for United was the home form has been so poor. There's been a lack of goals. The away form has been fine, both in league. They're about to watch tonight the Carabao Cup. And this is another chance for... And I think Ole Gunnar needs his first trophy. I think it's really important that he gets a trophy this season. He's been in the job 2 years now, as of a couple of days ago. And a trophy will definitely lift the spirits and win over some of the doubters. As you say, the doubters are never far away. If United lost tonight, there would be people on social media saying, he's not the man for us, he's got to go. That, again, does not reflect reality. The mood is usually set at games by the fans inside the stadium. That is not happening now. So you're getting this exaggerated, accelerated reaction to anything Manchester United do, including putting six past Leeds United. And that can dissipate very quickly. Even within a match, you see United fans going crazy if they go a goal behind and then celebrating at the end of the match. I think it's a social media phenomenon.
When you say a trophy is very important, Louis van Gaal might beg to differ for starters. I mean, how important is a Carabao Cup or even an FA Cup? Like, it would strike me if Solskjaer finishes seventh and wins the Carabao Cup, then he's in for a tricky summer where he'll be looking over his shoulder. I really do wonder about the importance of a Carabao Cup or an FA Cup.
If you look at Manchester United's ratings, then the manager ratings, the approval ratings, if you like, and I suppose it's my job to sense them, to sense what the mood is, I think a League Cup would lift by 10%. Nobody's saying this is going to alter the course of Manchester United's history. And the FA Cup by 15%. And winning the league obviously makes you untouchable for a while. They're not going to win the Champions League this year. I think the Europa League is absolutely worth winning. But as you say, if United were to finish seventh, he would have an uneasy summer. And his job wouldn't be guaranteed because seventh is not good enough for Manchester United when you've been in the job for 2 years. At the moment, it doesn't look like United are going to finish seventh, but closer to the third where the team finished last year. But there's only been 13 league games played, but United have won seven of them. They only won four of the first 14 games last year. There's been a marked improvement, admittedly compared to a very poor start to last season.
Like, their last Premier League defeat, in fairness to Solskjaer, was Arsenal on November 1st. As you said, they're 5 points off Liverpool. They have a game in hand. Even post the Leeds win, you have the likes of Roy Keane on Sky Sports, you know, almost venturing the opinion that perhaps this year they could be best of the rest. I think everybody increasingly feels Liverpool will win this league title quite comfortably. But if United were best of the rest somehow, and that may well depend on City's form as much as anything, that would be serious improvement. What are you seeing in the performances? Because to continue a theme, when they're good, they're very good.
Yeah, they're scoring goals and there's wonderful, exciting football. And when United beat Sheffield United, who'd not won all season last week, it probably showed where Manchester United were at. Scoring goals, showing some brilliant football, and yet it was a nervy finish. This team is not a vintage Manchester United team. The manager will say that. He certainly won't get carried away. He'll knock back any title talk. And as you say, Liverpool are far more complete. Manchester City have got a more complete squad than Manchester United. And that's why I didn't think the Manchester derby, boring though it was the disaster that some people thought it was, because United are winning the rest of the matches. I think there's been an improvement among individual players and there needs to be more. you look at players like Anthony Martial, he's not been consistent enough this season as he was last year. Marcus Rashford's having a good season. I wouldn't say great for any of them, really. Mm. David De Gea, ups and downs. Dean Henderson is pushing for that number one spot. But the season started really poorly and the defence was quite rightly criticised. The midfield is still uncertain. And when I say that, you don't know who Ollie will start in his midfield against any team. Mm. Against Liverpool next month, which is looking like a huge game, I'll be an hour before the game and I won't know what the team is likely to be because he's so unpredictable. So that strikes me that he hasn't fully settled on what he wants. Bruno Fernandes remains the most important player, the most creative player, but there are question marks over others. Paul Pogba, his situation blew up at the start of this month, and yet he's actually played well in recent weeks.
Yeah, the volatility in the team selection is quite something. It's amazing, really. You genuinely, I mean, hardened Manchester United fans who are watching every minute of every game and reading every dispatch from the club would do well to guess the starting 11. And, you know, there's adaptable and there's just unsettled and still trying to figure things out. And you suspect it's the latter. On Mason Greenwood, so Martial and Rashford and Greenwood, you know, so much of United's fortune is going to rest on how they're doing month to month. There were some interesting comments from the club even about Greenwood, I think it was last month, Andy, about him maybe not looking after himself well enough and struggling to be a good professional, I guess. What's going on there? What's the word there?
Well, I wrote about him and I spoke to specialists about him, professionals who work with young footballers, and he's a teenager who's had a huge change in his life and he's a good lad. He's done very well since he's come through. Of course, the coaches would like him to look at Edinson Cavani and the way that he trains and just follow his actions. And they could probably say that about Brandon Williams as well. These young lads have come into huge amounts of money. They're living in a lockdown. They have trust issues knowing who the best friend is and who some of the people are who just appeared on the scene. They've got lots of time to kill, and nobody really has any sympathy for the young millionaire footballer at all. But they make mistakes. Teenagers make mistakes in every walk of life, and the United players have done that. When Brandon Williams got on a plane and flew to Greece and posted an image of him sat on a private jet decked in designer gear, it was the wrong thing to do. United fans were unhappy because a few days earlier Sevilla had knocked United out of the Europa League. And hopefully he'll learn from that and he won't do such a thing again. I think Greenwood is a phenomenal talent and he's got good people who care about him at the club. There's a lot of people around him away from the club. His family have moved to Manchester and I'm told they're a good influence as well. But it's a challenge with young players, especially in the modern era where mistakes are magnified on social media, when everybody has camera phones. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson had it with Lee Sharp and Ryan Giggs as they were growing up in the world as well. But all of their errors were not plastered all over the internet within 5 minutes of them happening.
Solskjaer said of Pogba just this week that post the Mino Raiola comments, he's got a very, very good attitude to training and to his football. So the fallout from Raiola, Andy, what are you hearing?
I don't think Pogba's professionalism in terms of his training has ever been an issue. He's a popular lad among the players. But clearly you might say that he's highly unprofessional of his agent when he's doing comments like the ones he did before a huge game away at Leipzig. That didn't go down well at the club, whatever anybody says. It's not the first time that it's happened. And United fans feel pretty underwhelmed by Paul Pogba. They had big expectations when he arrived for a world record fee in 2016. Be it injury, changing managers, or woeful inconsistency, he hasn't fulfilled his own dreams, nor those of the fans. And if he left the club tomorrow, I don't think there'd be too many disappointed Manchester United fans. Maybe disappointed in the sense of, it's sad that it didn't work out. But when his agent comes out and talks, that really annoys United fans. I still think he'll get chances, because the squad isn't strong enough not to give a player as talented as him chances. You can't just cut him out. And I know that on a personal level, Ole Gunnar actually gets on well with Paul Pogba. And he's popular around Carrington. he's a polite lad. In my own dealings with him, he's a polite young man.
Mm.
But then you see what his agent comes out with, and clearly he knows about that because it's his agent. And that doesn't sit well, not with the club, not with his teammates, and not with the fans who think, well, if you want to go, just go.
Mm.
Manchester United's not a village football team. You either want to be here or you don't want to be here.
It's amazing the extent to which his footballing stock has even plummeted this season. He's routinely on the bench, and it's not like there's any outcry or discord, be it from pundits watching in a studio or fans in so much as you can take the temperature in social media. It's just like, yeah, I think most people can see why Solskjaer would have him on the bench. Even when they lose a game, you're not seeing great cries of, well, oh my God, Pogba's on the bench, in the same way we might see it with Ozil at Arsenal at the moment. That is kind of extraordinary when you stop and think about it.
It is for a player so talented. When he has come off the bench, he's actually performed well. He did really well in Paris where he set up Marcus Rashford's winner, but he hasn't deserved to start. The manager's making the correct decision because Paul Pogba often has played poorly within matches. He's conceded possession, he's let his head go down, he's been affected by the noise around him. And your original point is quite right. I don't see Real Madrid or Barcelona queuing up to buy Paul Pogba. A, because of the COVID economy around football, but even if they were both flush with cash, I still don't see them singling him out as a prime target because, quite frankly, there are better players than him. If you look at the metrics, which all the top clubs do, and judge players using hard data over 40 different samples, Pogba's not coming out at the top of them.
Mm.
And that's not justifying huge transfer fees, and United would want a big transfer fee if they sold him at the moment. But I sense that his contract will run down. He might even leave for a free. And I don't think he's got the number of suitors that he may have had a year or two ago. I know for a fact that he hasn't.
A last one for you, because I know you're busy and probably freezing.
I'm freezing.
It's been a good week for Scott McTominay. And the parallels with Fletcher extend beyond being Scottish and blonde and hard running. He's also on a similar trajectory, you feel, you know, developing slowly but surely. I think he's 24 now. If he keeps going like this, you can see, a la Fletcher, him getting to 27, 28, being a really important player for Manchester United in the really big games.
I agree with all that, and I hope that Manchester United are good enough to reach European Cup finals like they did when Darren Fletcher was there, even though he missed out in one of them because of a booking he'd taken in the semi-final. I thought the game against Leeds was his best match, scored two goals, because he hasn't been scoring enough goals. His fitness is fantastic. Jose Mourinho was the one who picked him out, promoted him and praised him. There are United fans still to be won over by him because technically he doesn't have the skills of somebody like Paul Pogba. But great, successful teams need squads. And if you look at the great United teams, there's been players like Darren Fletcher, who you mentioned, like John O'Shea, who've been really important to the success of Manchester United. They might have played 30, 40, even 50 games in their best seasons. And I think Scott has been a success and he continues to improve with experience and hopefully get stronger with the knocks. And it's not easy for him because he's not playing in a Fergie side where they're winning everything. He's playing in a side which is still in transition, which is still inconsistent, which started the season as badly as it did this year for many reasons. But he's coming stronger and he's coming good. And what I notice, because I'm at these matches, he's always the most vocal player on the pitch.
Right.
And I pointed that out in Istanbul, and nobody was there to see it in the flesh. And I got a barrage of abuse because people said, he might be vocal, but anyone can go around shouting. And one guy even messaged me and said, he cannot play football. And I remembered that. And at the weekend, I replied to him and said, you're still saying that Scott McTominay cannot play football. And I don't usually do that.
Mm.
And of course, he was anonymous. They're always anonymous, aren't they? But I thought it was pretty unfair because my brothers played semi-professional football and they were really good.
Mm.
So how good have you got to be to play for a huge team like Manchester United?
Quite good, I would think. So, final one. Carlo Ancelotti's getting a tune out of this Everton side. We're talking ahead of knowing the teams, but this is no easy game.
It's a difficult game. Everton have improved. They've obviously spent a fortune. They've got a top manager. They brought in top players like James Rodriguez. And when United came here in November, the narrative was Everton are really good. They're going to hammer United. And that didn't happen. United have still got better players than them. This was the ground where David Moyes lost his job. It's where Ole Gunnar saw his team lose 4-0. But I'm more confident, but then it's I've got no idea what the team's going to be.
It's true.
But I feel that Everton really need a trophy as well. I speak to a lot of Evertonians, and it would be a bigger lift for Everton than it would be for Manchester United. But I still think this is worth winning for Manchester United.
Okay. Well, to a very cold Andy Mitten at Goodison, thanks so much for that. Enjoy the game. Have a great Christmas. Thanks for all the contributions across the year, Andy. It's much appreciated.
It's really nice to talk to you. And same to you and to everybody who's watching or listening. I've enjoyed it.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Second half underway at Goodison Park. It's nil-all between Everton and Manchester United. United with the better of the first half, 61% possession, 10 attempts to Everton's 4, but it is nil-all. Seamus Coleman captains Everton this evening. Paul Pogba is playing for United. Van de Beek started as well. Bruno Fernandes started. They're playing with Diamond. It's Cavani and Greenwood leading the line for Manchester United this evening. Later on, we're going to talk to Tim Vickery. Last time he was on the show, he paid a brilliant tribute. He got great feedback from lots of you to Diego Maradona on his passing. Tim's going to look back on the year that was, give us an international flavour, because Dan McDonnell is going to give us the Irish version of the Irish Independent. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Joe. Happy Christmas and all of that.
Oh, don't say it like that.
Well, I mean, I do actually mean it, but you know, it's that time of year where it's like, you don't always mean it to everyone you say, but I actually do mean it to you. I mean, I hope you're having a good Christmas. I think you're in sort of wind down mode, aren't you? You're on the way out now, are you? This is it.
Dan, it's been a long year. It has been a long year. A lot of nights in here. Sometimes without much sport on. I'm in my last hour until I think January 4th or 5th. So frankly, my plan here, Dan, is eating celebrations under the desk and nodding anytime you're talking and looking at me.
Right. Is that different from your standard performance, or is that related to your previous point in any way? I don't know.
Oh, dear. Excuse me. Sorry. My headphones fell out there. You're having a go at
me,
though.
This is full wind-down mode here. This is last day of school mode here.
No. Listen. Yeah. Professional to the end. So the plan here, Philippe Auclair did this last night, and it was good fun. It's a nice way to kind of review the year. We've asked some of our favourite people on, i.e. you, Dan. To give some thoughts on the year that was. So you have sent on a few bits and pieces which you would like to touch on. In no particular order, they include FAI off the field, naturally. Brexit, you have obviously Republic of Ireland in a big way on the pitch, Mick McCarthy's departure, we have Stephen Kenny era, League of Ireland as well, and actually on the League of Ireland front, you've texted me just before coming on air saying, don't go to the League of Ireland review at 9:31. So I won't do that. We'll get to it early. Sometimes we get into tangents. Whatever's last on the list, we never get to it.
But it's all part of the same thing, really, in many respects.
It
overlaps with Brexit and a lot of the other stuff.
Well, the Brexit thing is interesting. The Brexit thing is not interesting, but what it means for Irish football is genuinely significant. So we will come to that and we will touch on what that means for League of Ireland as well as the League of Ireland season that has been. Before we proceed any further, I just want to give a shout out to Ian O'Brien. He's from Carrigaline. He's a Cork City fan, Dan, based on his Twitter feed. You tweeted that you were on the way after 9 o'clock, and Ian O'Brien tweeted you back saying, that's my podcast run sorted. So Ian's not listening live, and I'm curious to see, as he's out for his run tomorrow morning, if he hears this and goes, oh my God, they're talking about me. So we'll see, does Ian follow through in his promise to one, go for the run, debatable, Christmas Eve, if ever there's a day you're going to take off, and two, to listen to us. So Ian O'Brien, head for your run. Happy Christmas Eve from me and Dan.
Yeah, hopefully it's a better one for Cork City, because they've had a pretty disastrous 2020. Hope they have a better 2021.
So look, I'm gonna follow your lead a little bit here. I mean, I guess the starting point is if you lose an Irish manager or say goodbye to an Irish manager and hire a new one, not least, Stephen Kenny and where he's come from, then that's the big talking point in some ways. I will get into the off-the-field stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all interconnected. One of the real tests, I suppose, for the new FAI was to figure out what the hell to do with the cancelled Euros, and does Mick McCarthy get to stay on now until the Euros, or how do we handle that? On balance, in hindsight and even at the time, we all felt they handled it pretty well and quite cleanly, and Meet McCarthy made as dignified an exit as it could all, you know, be hoped for?
No, I think so. I mean, maybe some of his commentary stuff was less dignified, but the actual exit itself. I mean, if you think about where we were this time 12 months ago, you do that in life with everything, you know, in every subject and every review. But I suppose when you consider that 2019 was probably the most turbulent year in Irish football history, or certainly a contender. So I mean, they'd had like a year of crisis before they hit into the pandemic year, and naturally it sort of, you know, it had an impact in a very, very dramatic way. And I mean, this time last year we were looking at Shane Ross, we were looking at would the FAI even survive. I mean, it always was probably going to, but I mean, the issue of solvency and stuff was there hanging into January, and we always had this thing over our heads of, well, we have that playoff in March, could qualify for the Euros in the summer. That could maybe be the shot in the arm that the game needs. And then everything changes, as we know. And like, as that's, I mean, in hindsight, like everyone is a genius, you know, and there are still people there who certainly hold the view that they shouldn't have changed manager at that stage. And they made that point loudly after Ireland lost on penalties. But, you know, some people had made that point before it as well. And you know, I would have had the view, certainly, and I think I wrote about this at the time back in April, which feels like, you know, years ago at this stage. I think if Stephen Kenny's first game was Slovakia away, I can understand why you might leave Mick in charge for that. But really, once the contracts were timed, you know, were pretty rigid, they were time dated, they did what they had to do. There was more complications in not doing it, really. And just because it didn't work out the way you would have wanted doesn't mean it wasn't the right decision. Like, I think that it still makes more sense now that Stephen Kenny got 8 games to adjust to the job, even if they didn't go particularly well, than a sort of a halfway house scenario where, you know, Mick McCarthy would have been in charge for games in September, maybe October, then we'll see what happened in November. You couldn't have done that. You clearly couldn't have done that. So it was the right call, but it was a, you know, it was an unfortunate way for things to end. But really, you know, in the and listen, I have full respect for Mick McCarthy and his great service to Irish football. But like, you know, in the context of what has been a pretty grim year for Irish football, and for a lot of people within Irish football who are still struggling on account of things that predate COVID, I guess, you know, it's sad he had to leave the way he did, but he did leave, you know, with more money than a lot of people have left Irish football. You know, he left with a deal. And that's what happens in management, and he's managing in Cyprus now. So, I mean, I think that it reached the most plausible, the most amicable conclusion you could have reached, and probably the only logical one, as much as there's points that could be made to the contrary.
He left with about £1 million, didn't he?
Yeah, and he would have been on more. He had this weird one of being on a bonus as well if they qualified, because they made a sort of a hard and fast rule. And actually, I can see why they did it. It was like, well, we've inherited these contracts, so we are going to honour them, even if some of these contracts are weird, you know. And that's basically what they decided to do. And Mick McCarthy, on account of the sort of idiosyncratic way in which this arrangement was put together, was entitled to X amount, and would have been entitled to more if Ireland had qualified, in the same way that Stephen Kenny was entitled to take over, you know, that Robbie Keane was entitled to go on to a bigger deal. And while there are sort of quirks and rights and wrongs with all of that, the new people there making decisions said, well, the easiest thing for us to do is just follow on from these deals, because we didn't make these decisions. And on balance, I can see why they did that, even though, but again, this is my point, you see some money going out of the association in different ways, and you think, yeah, that really sticks. So it doesn't really make, you know, the handover and Mick McCarthy losing out, you know, the great disappointment of the year. There's a lot more sad stories elsewhere.
And is Robbie Keane still on salary and in limbo?
He is, yeah, okay. He is. Nice work if you can get it, I guess. Like, it's again, Stephen Kenny was told from the start he could have his own backroom staff. And that was clear. And that, again, I think that is correct. You know, you don't foist someone on a manager. And again, that was clearly stated. I mean, I would have been aware of that back in 2018, that he would pick his own backroom staff. I guess, you know, over time, maybe he might have decided he'd wanted to work with Robbie Keane. But I think a lot of people would have been aware last year that wouldn't have been the case. And sure enough, it wasn't the case. but he's left on the FAI books. And look, I mean, again, he was given that. You know, he was given that, so it's not Robbie Keane's fault at all. And it's just obviously a strange one that he remains in that limbo. There has been speculation that the FAI have been trying to find a role for him of some description. He was linked with some other jobs, which didn't come to pass. But it's again, we still have a lot of bizarre things that lingering over from what went before, and that most certainly is one of them.
It was around this time last year as well, the extent of the FAI debt was made public. You know, you've just said there, let's take stock of the full year. I think the figure was just over 50 million, 50 million, which was seen as shocking at the time. Now, debt is as manageable as your earning power is. So, is 50 million an absolutely insane burden for an association the size of Ireland to carry? And this is before COVID comes into it either. But, like, was 50 million a real... a solvency issue? They have to get the government bailout, obviously, and that's painful and that's kind of embarrassing for football. But once they got that and kind of got things moving, it seemed the odd time we would hear from them, like they were kind of saying, look, this is manageable enough, we're not in any immediate danger anymore.
Yeah, but I think that's this. Like, there was a certain jubilation, you know, when that rescue deal was agreed, well, I think maybe the last day of January or thereabouts, you know, outside the Department of Sport, and there was a sense that they'd got a chance now. And the signing of that became a story later on, and Roy Barrett and all of that. But leave that to one side. Like, there was a feeling they got a very good deal from their various partners, which involved some of their commitments to the stadium being covered. And you are right. Like, debt of that size, they clearly felt at that stage it was manageable. Like, there was sort of various deals done around it. Now, but the problem, as you said, like, I mean, it's... I know we all flippantly say sort of pre-COVID as a thing, but it is like something that really came down the tracks really hard. I mean, they needed 13 million euro of COVID relief before the year was out. The League of Ireland wouldn't have restarted, I guess, without some kind of support indirectly coming from government to make it happen. And there is a feeling in 2021, with no crowds on the horizon in the short term at least, that they're going to need a similar amount, if not more, again. So really, the financial picture isn't very good at all. Yes, the debt, that debt figure, I guess, I mean, they've been managing that amount of over a long period of time, and they found a way to get by. Get by in the sense that, like, you know, the place doesn't go in flames, and you don't turn out the lights, but it's not necessarily conducive to, you know, proper investment and spending in football. You know, like, you can pay your bills, and you can pay your staff, and, you know, as we've seen in the past, you can occasionally hire a big money manager or pay big contracts to certain people. But I guess in terms of, like, putting a sustained amount of money into the, you know, development, really proper funding, properly funding stuff, that debt figure means that if you do have, like, a big win, say you qualify for a tournament or something like that, it's more likely that that money is probably going to be funneled towards servicing debts and commitments rather than necessarily growing the game. And, like, you know, like, this is one of the debates, like the Brexit thing, for example, potentially, you know, puts the spotlight on our ability here to really manage the development of elite footballers between the age of 16 and 18. And we don't have the structures here to do that. And what, I mean, you could talk about ways of doing it, but the easiest way is like more funding, obviously. Everyone wants more funding.
Yeah.
And the FAI's fundamental problem is that it's snookered in what they can do by their financial situation. So, yeah, they've survived, you know, the lights being turned off permanently. But they're still sort of fumbling around in the dark a bit a lot of the time.
Yeah. So the debt may well be serviceable, but it doesn't mean it's not incredibly damaging to this period of Irish football, which is such a grim thought. And anyone who's, you know, followed the shenanigans within the FAI over the last decade, it would infuriate you if you care about the game and you love the game and you played the game growing up and you would like your kids to play the game. It's just, it's ridiculous what's happened. It really is. One last point before we get into Brexit then. So Mick McCarthy's departure followed by Stephen Kenny. Now, I deliberately don't do too much. I break with habit, Dan. I don't do too much research before these kind of chats because I think what comes to you is almost what will come to me in 5 years' time when I think back on his era. So what comes to me here, the ill-fated seating plan on a certain flight to Slovakia.
Yeah.
The Conor Hourihan chance replays in my mind over and over again. And then a video pre-Wembley, the leak, the fallout, and maybe as much as anything, Stephen Kenny in his press conference saying that there are some, I don't want to misquote him. Did he say forces? Did he say people? He may say people.
He said behind the scenes. He definitely used the term behind the scenes.
Who don't have the best interest of the team at heart. Now, he didn't specify if that was people in the FAI. I increasingly think he's talking about people in the FAI, which is, you know, that's the big story in some ways. Or he could have been talking about agents or other people who get involved and hear bits from a dressing room and
leave it to them. There'll be a bit of everything, Joe, I think.
Okay. So that's where I am on Stephen Kenny. And ultimately, look, just can't score a goal at the moment. So where are we on part one of Stephen Kenny's tenure, if we're breaking it into parts?
Yeah, but it is. I mean, if Conor Hartland takes that chance, we don't talk about the other two, you know, and that's the thing, the other 3 points you raise.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, that is missed, the penalty shootout is lost, and then, it just turns into a really like a bit of a disaster. And maybe I don't like to use that word lightly, obviously, because I mean, we're dealing with a sort of pandemic and all of that, but in the context of like our narrow focus of Irish football, like, you know, it was a disastrous international window. October and also November, and the fallout, as you mentioned, like, you know, I think I was doing a piece in it, like an end of year piece or maybe an early 21 piece for the paper, just trying to wrap up some of my thoughts on this as well. And like, you know Stephen Kenny came in with a wave of goodwill to some degree, but I think obviously there would have possibly been some people, say within Irish football, I think who maybe wouldn't maybe have shared that. And I say that in the sense that all of a sudden, like, he was elevated to the top, to a position of authority that probably, maybe you could argue that nobody within Irish football has been given before in a footballing context, a football man in the sense that, like, he came in, you know, on the road to senior manager, was given responsibility over the under, effectively like an overlord figure when he was 21's manager in terms of the underage managers and all that, you know, funneling up towards him. And then given this position on the executive, effectively, and you know, the importance or otherwise of that, or the, you know, whether that's just a symbolic thing or meaningful thing, has been debated. But it is a position that's there. And he also then came in, you know, September and really decided to change his entire backroom staff. I mean, never mind the high profile stuff. I mean, he really cleared out a lot of people that were there a long time, brought in his own people, and had made a decision to really go for it and try and create this you know, new environment for the team. But in doing that, you do knock quite a lot of noses out of joint, that just happens. And listen, that leads you vulnerable to the type of sort of murmurs and whispers and stuff that happens in every workplace, in every life, you know, every walk of life, you know, in every dressing room. There will be, you know, X amount of players, staff, and like, what do you do? What do people do when they work somewhere? They'll gossip and talk about people that work above them, and I didn't like that, wasn't sure about that, and you have people who are disaffected by maybe changes that have happened, and really that's normal. But then when you don't win games, those murmurs can lead to something else. And what we then saw was, you know, definitely mischievous leaks in November, where, without, you know, going into specifics, I think it's fair to say that there would be a lot of people around the game that would have a fair idea where they think stuff might be coming from. And it's probably loosely linked to maybe the dissatisfaction with changes that may have happened. And that's part of the growing pains of like a regime change. If you come in and try and change a lot straight away, you need to hit the ground running for that to run smoothly. But because they haven't hit the ground running on the pitch, it left them open, I think, to some stuff off the pitch, which, you know, as I said, it was some mischievous stuff. And even the coordination and timing and content of certain stuff that came out afterwards. I'm not sure if it was necessarily people, if the tracks were covered in such a way that it wasn't so obvious where stuff may or may not have been coming from. And maybe if Stephen Kenny can, rather than obsess over perhaps where that came from and what the intentions of people were, it has the potential to be a galvanizing force if you use it in the right way. And you know, maybe take stock of some things that happened over the last couple of months, see what you can learn from it, and go into March with the players and everyone from the start and say, listen, there was a lot of crap there. What do we need to do? Because at one point, it's not, I think there's a view out there, and I think you get text messages in there all the time, and I've had comments like this. Like, there is a view out there that, well, you know, there's some people in the media or shows are giving Stephen Kenny a very soft ride. You know, he's getting an easy time of it here. And almost a sense that maybe after 7 or 8 games, like, we should be losing our heads. Now, I think that was Owen or someone. Owen maybe made a good point on Off the Ball recently. I thought it was phrased quite well. There's some people who didn't want the transition to happen. I understand why they're angry and raging. And that's completely natural. But from my perspective, I felt like the Stephen Kenny appointment was an important thing to try something different, to break away from the cycle of just appointing a manager, throwing loads of money at him, you know, and just qualify for the next tournament, and that's it. And there was a logic in putting your foot in the ball, trying something different that may take time. But having called for years for that approach to be tried, you're not going to, after 7-8 games, suddenly go, actually, all that stuff for years about trying something patient, a couple of results aren't going well, let's lose the plot and say this is a disgrace, and this is a disgrace. We always suggested it might take time, and it is taking time. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, but it does mean, like, we've had a very unusual time in our lives. And I think one of the problems that Stephen Kenny has probably encountered, and he's made all of those changes to staff and everything, and then got into a hotel situation where people can't mingle like they normally can, where family and people can't come to the hotel, where players can't leave for a day off. And I think it's been quite intense. The environment's been intense, and it hasn't maybe led itself to the type of sort of harmony and sort of atmosphere that you would normally associate with an Irish senior team camp. And that is influenced by the factors that have affected all of our lives. And I think in that respect, he deserves a bit of time to get over that and see where we go from March, hopefully in a sort of a better environment.
Okay. Still nil all at Goodison with 67 minutes on the clock. We're reviewing the Irish footballing year with Dan McDonnell. You mentioned Brexit a few moments ago, Dan. Don't switch off, everyone. Don't switch off. I will
stick with it briefly. Let's be brief.
I'll keep this interesting. Here we go. Stick with me for 30 seconds on Brexit. So under FIFA rules, basically, clubs cannot sign a player from another country until they turn 18. There is an exception, though. EU country to EU country, you can sign a player once they're 16, as long as you offer the provision of education, which most clubs do. Now, between 30 and 50 of Ireland's best footballers go to the UK aged 16 or 17 every year. Every year, our 30 to 50 best footballers go aged 16 or 17. This has been the likes of, you know, the most recent batch. Paris did that, Quevin Kelleher, Adam Eda, Jason Knight, Aaron Connolly, Malumbi, you name it. So now, Dan, it would seem that the best 30 to 50 Irish footballers each year, aged 16 and 17, are going to need to be developed here across these 2 to 3 crucial years before they can go to the UK. What's the plan for them?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem. There's actually no plan to be ready for that. Now, they may not stay. They may go to Europe. Or in fact, some of them may still go. We'll see. Like, there's, you know, there's, as ever with Brexit, there's, you know, there's clause A, B, C, and I'm not sure if English clubs have fully given up on the option to take these players. But really, that's almost by the by, because what the whole thing has exposed is how we're not prepared for it. Like, the announcement that our players have to stay at home should be a cause for celebration. Like, you know, all things being equal, it should be a great news story. It should be welcomed as such. It's like, we speak so many times on these shows about sending our players away early. They come home. Yeah, you mentioned the ones that are doing well there. But for all those ones you mentioned, there's, you know, 9 times as many who come home broken, no education, disillusioned with the game and the sport. And now we're faced with a situation where it's very possible that more of them, if not all of them, you know, will be staying here. But what we don't have is a structure to actually embrace that, to develop Quevin Kelleher and Jason Malumbi and Aaron Connolly and whatever, and to give them the caliber of coaching and contact hours and, you know, exposure to specialised skills, etc., that they would get at the, you know, the Premier League equivalents. And really, for all that we've spoken a lot in recent years about certain changes that have been made, positive changes, national underage leagues, there's been sort of various initiatives that I think the FAI can take credit for, and people like Rude Doctor can take credit for. The fact is, all you can do is speak to people on the ground who are engaged in the sharp end of development of the sport, who don't just talk about it after Ireland have a bad loss and then forget about it for, like, you know, 5 years. These are the people who live it 365 days a year, and they're worried about this. They think it's going to cause problems for our elite players because we're still not ready. There's still a fractured relationships within the game. There's a view. I saw Gavin Cooney did a piece in the Fortitude today and touched on some points. Rude Doctor, for example, who's, as I said, has been responsible for some good changes, but doesn't really seem to be communicating regularly with people who are out there on the ground, who are influential figures at the top academies, who feel that they're not spoken to enough. So it feels like we have this amazing opportunity, but we're not actually ready to capitalize on it. Almost to the point that people are saying, well, actually, maybe it would be a good thing if this doesn't happen. So we can just keep exporting our players like we normally do, even though that leads to, like, disaster for a lot of the people who do go. So that's a pretty grim sort of picture to paint. Yeah. And, like, people don't get around a table and talk enough about these things, you know? And, like, I mean, that's still a legacy of what went before, I think.
I haven't heard much from our new CEO, by the way. Is that striking news odd? Have I missed him somewhere? Has he been out?
Well, he's done it. He did a staff meeting with the FAI recently with the staff.
But I mean, talking to the Irish football in public.
No, but I think there's a conscious desire maybe to not be front and centre. Okay. That, like, you know, every press release that went out in the FAI in recent years, you know, in the Delaney years, whatever, well, if it was good news, obviously, if it was bad news, if it was Fran Gavin or someone.
Yeah.
But if it's good news, you know, or, you know, condolences to someone, the CEO was front and center. I think Jonathan Hill, the new CEO, English CEO, has indicated he won't be doing that.
Right.
But he's got a new sponsor, you know, maybe sorting out sponsorship for the League of Ireland. And, like, that debt that you mentioned, and all this commercial acumen, he's got a lot on his plate. But because of COVID, he still hasn't actually moved here. He's sort of working remotely like a lot of people, but he's going to be a big voice in 2021. But I'm not necessarily sure if he's going to be a big press voice and he's going to be going to newspaper Christmas parties.
Fair enough. Okay, so he may not be getting armchair rides from fans or putting his tie around his head, is what you're saying to me.
It's unlikely, you know.
But we don't know for sure.
We don't know for sure.
Dan.
Yeah.
I got to interrupt here. You texted me at the start and said, don't you dare come to me on the League of Ireland at 9:31. It's 9:29, so...
Right. This is what happens, Joe.
No, sorry, that's on you as much as me. I got to work through. Yeah, okay. Come on.
Yeah, I gave some long answers there. I didn't even let you talk, you know. But you're eating your celebration, so I don't interrupt.
I sure am, Dan. I'm half an hour away from freedom. But
listen,
for the time being.
It was half a season.
Yes.
It was half a season anyway.
Yeah.
So what?
Look, Shamrock Rovers are the dominant team and they look to be in a really good place. Dundalk have had a messy season, weird season, kind of a sheen on it with the cup final win. General big picture League of Ireland stuff, what are the key things you want to say about this year into next year?
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is that it happened, which is possibly a good thing, when it looked like the shutters were going to come down. But the problem is that we still don't really know now in December when it'll start in 2021, how it will be funded. Will that streaming service exist again? Will there be crowds? So again, like, I mean, there's uncertainty every winter, but this is like a really extreme version of that.
And sorry to interrupt, when you say how it will be funded, as in because there won't be spectators for potentially the whole season. Okay.
So they're going to need a package again. I mean, there was a support package, you know, based of, you know, some monies from government, state, some redistribution of funds, or they didn't charge other things. You can put whatever figure you want on it. They needed a rescue package to get the season going. They're going to need another one to get this season going, realistically. So there was some nice stuff to happen on the pitch. I mean, Shamrock Rovers are very good. Jack Byrne was great. You know, the dog got to the group stages, even though, you know, people wondered whether Dundalk's American ownership would lead to a sustained period of dominance. But he's sort of, capitalists out to dominate. But actually, they've shown great generosity of spirit by actually taking Dundalk down off the perch and letting everyone else sort of have a go, take some of their players for free. There's interesting issues there and all, but yet what's hanging over it is we don't really know what's going to be funded, you know, how it's going to happen, when's it going to start. And it's really like everything, we talk about debt at the start. I mean, it's caught up in the same thing, everything within football, and people involved in other aspects and sectors of the game will have their own issues of the same nature. We've always acknowledged that like a strong League of Ireland is needed, but at the moment, I mean, it's not in any position. Like, they should be debating the All-Ireland League and various things that have come up across the year, but really no one has time to do that because they're waiting to see well, how are we actually going to start this season, and will we have fans? And listen, football without fans, I was lucky. I got to go to a load of games this year. A lot of people didn't. But it's a soulless experience. You're really not missing out on anything. And I think particularly in the League of Ireland, for all that it gets denigrated for smaller crowds, in many respects, the crowd that go are more influential on the match day experience than they would be in stadiums that house 40, 50,000 sometimes, yeah. You know? And really, like, you know, there's bigger picture issues as ever that need to be resolved long term, but there's pressing short term ones that prevent us from having the long term discussions. And that's a pretty grim. I feel like we should have something uplifting here, Joe. Like, is there anything, you know, we're finishing on a bit of a low, but there is a lot of, there's a lot of lows on that, you know. I should mention.
Well, I've got a tweet in here.
Go on.
Okay.
Go on.
Lads, we're in the depths of depression in Irish football for years to come, says Obi123.
There's an uplifting one. The one thing, I think it was actually Will Clark who made the point in the Gavin Cooney. Will Clark's the director at St. Joseph's Boys.
Yeah.
Like, if you actually look at it, like I watched Nathan Collins play earlier on for Stoke against Spurs. He did quite well. You've got Jason Knight, you've got Adam Eda, Aaron Connolly. Okay, he was latter end of last year. But actually the amount of like Irish teenagers who've broken through at a good level this year and done quite well. I think Will made the point. It's the type of thing that people in other countries would look at and go, they must be doing something right in Ireland. Yeah. Yet actually, we're doing loads wrong and still getting some good players, which makes you think, God, if we could actually somehow get everything pulling together in the right way, what could we do? Yeah. Because we do have a good generation of players on the way, and that should be up. Dar O'Shea, just, you know, countless others, really.
Yeah.
But we just need a more, we need foundation sort of, well, for them to sit on.
Here's the hope for optimism then in various quarters. That new generation continues to develop, and they are a good generation. Stephen Kenny has a decent World Cup qualifying group innings. Maybe we don't make the World Cup, but that's acceptable and there's progress. And then we're really poised to kick on, hopefully under Kenny, you know, widely adjudged to have done a very good job for the Euros, and we get to the Euros and play some good football there. League of Ireland package needed next year, but then fans are back, we have vaccines, and League of Ireland kicks on, maybe because they got a few kids from Brexit who are coming in, and there's a youthful exuberance to proceedings. And Jonathan Hill continues to not tie his tie around his head and get armchair rides and brings in sponsorship money, and maybe this debt hanging over us all isn't so crippling, and we can also develop the game a little bit here.
Listen, stick all that down in a letter and send it to Santa, Joe. Like, that's a really nice end of year wish there. It's a nice thought. If one of those things can happen, it might even be a good year.
Listen, thank you for all your contributions across the year. Hugely appreciated and valued as ever, my man. Have a great Christmas. Thanks so much.
And to you. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Dan McDonald there of the Irish Independent. Still nil all, Everton United, 78 minutes on the clock at Goodison. We will talk to Tim Vickery next.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunluey.net.
Now, York Max, so still nil all at Goodison Park. Everton nil, Manchester United nil. 10 minutes to go. Tim Vickery, hello.
Hello, very good evening to you.
You look very dapper.
Yeah, well, I was doing a podcast earlier on about the Christmas truce in the First World War. So I got into character with a kind of Edwardian collar. Maybe went a little bit too far, took it too seriously. But, you know, you've got to take your players where you can get them in these troubled times.
Well, indeed. There's a text in from Graham when I mentioned you were coming on. He says, question for the great man in Rio, which I liked.
I don't know who he is. You've only got me, I fear.
Does anybody call him Timothy?
No. Never. My dad did when he was very angry with me, which was fairly often. But no.
If you heard Timothy, there was trouble.
I don't think anyone has done it and lived.
Okay. If you heard Timothy from your dad, there was trouble.
Yeah.
Often the way.
It was like those kind of cartoon things when people hit you. It was a bit like that, you know, when he gave me a belt. It was old school. He was born in 1924. It's a different generation.
It sure was. So the year that was, we got great feedback, by the way, when you were on talking about the death of Maradona. We asked you to send in a few bits and bobs. We've been doing that with a few different contributors over the last couple of days. You mentioned again the death of Maradona, which we don't necessarily need to go over again. You mentioned Rossi as well. Was he a big deal for you? Were you a Rossi man?
Well, because these are some of the World Cups of my youth, you know, 82 and 86. You know, if Maradona was the star of 86, then Rossi was the star of 82. And no, I do feel a little bit like parts of my youth are being chipped away bit by bit. For me, and I don't think it's just personal nostalgia, I think they were the last two truly great World Cups. You know, the next one along, 1990, although we English have happy reasons to remember it, FIFA recognised it was a huge disappointment with the lowest amount of goals scored, I think, per game, I think, in any World Cup. They tried to free talent afterwards by clamping down on tough tackling. But soon after that, the kind of juggernaut of European club football takes over as the game's main event. And it's taken its toll, I think, on the World Cup, because the big problem that the World Cup has had in recent times is that come the end of the season, players are absolutely on their knees physically because of the exertions that the European club season demands of them. So I don't think the last World Cups, I don't think they'll live in the memory anything like the way that 82 and 86 will. I did have hopes that by hook and by crook, for probably not particularly great reasons, I had hopes of the next World Cup, because you know, it's being held in the middle of the European season, December. I hoped, and the process by which that happened clearly was far from satisfactory. But my hope was that, you know, because this was in the middle of the season, you'd get to see the best players closer to peak fitness. But I fear that the coronavirus situation has removed that advantage. You know, so many games are being piled on that I think any hope that players would be at their rested best in time for that World Cup have since been denied. So for me, you're probably too young to remember those World Cups first up. But 82 and 86 had some absolutely magical moments, which I don't think have really been repeated in subsequent tournaments.
Well, I was just going to make the point, because I remember, and maybe it is an age thing, I remember 98 incredibly fondly, and I quite liked 02 as well. I thought that had something going for it.
So, 02, Joe Malloy, was an absolute unmitigated disaster.
Was it?
Yeah, and I shall tell you, FIFA will recognise this, and I shall tell you why. Because in order to avoid the rainy season in Japan and South Korea, it was held early. It was held and it started the end of May.
Yeah.
So it was like it started 2 weeks earlier than normal World Cups have started. And it meant that there was absolutely no time for... And remember, the Champions League at that stage, it had two group stages. They'd gone all out with...
Well, that was a grim time in all our lives, yeah.
Well, yeah. And it meant that come the World Cup, the players who'd been through the European season were just absolutely physically on their knees. And the big favourites were France and Argentina.
I remember the opening day, Senegal, France, like vividly. See, I'm wondering then if this is just all about your age, where you are in your life, Tim. You know,
I think it has a lot to do with it, that kind of subjective thing. But I think objectively, I mean, I did it's the highlight of what I ludicrously call my career, or one of them. It's the interview that I did just after that World Cup in 2002 with Brazil's head of physical preparation, who very graciously, because he could have said I won the World Cup, but what he said was Brazilian physical preparation culture, there are 15 who could have been in my position, but we won the World Cup because Inter Milan couldn't get Ronaldo fit, we got him fit. Barcelona said Rivaldo couldn't play. He wasn't fit enough to play. We got him fit. Cafu and Roberto Carlos, who'd played the European season that everyone else had, they were full of beans running up and down. Why? Because we developed individual training programs. But we were ahead because of the domestic calendar of Brazilian football, because it has so many games. We had been forced, he said, to develop a type of physical training program that enabled players to get out on the field even when there were so many games being played. The Europeans hadn't done that, and the consequence of this was that those who played the European season were absolutely on their knees. I mean, the team that they really feared were France, who lost Zidane a few days before the tournament. He'd played the final game on one leg, but didn't even score a goal. And Argentina, who were brilliant in qualification with that high running Bielsa style, they couldn't do it either. Portugal, who had a good side, I think they lost something like 4-0 to the United States because they just couldn't put one leg in front of the other. So it was a World Cup that had shocks, but it didn't have quality.
Okay. Interesting. Look, I was on my summer holidays. I was having like four bowls of cornflakes, chilling out, watching the matches. I had a great time.
Good.
You've turned that upside down for me. So Maradona, Rossi, chipping away at your youth. Messi has scored goal number 644. So in his 17th season, he's beaten the Pelé record of scoring most goals at a single club. Pelé at Santos in his 18 years had held the record, seemingly unbreakable. Well, it was always going to be broken maybe when Messi came along. But God, it feels unbreakable now going forward, not least because it's at one club. So Messi, 644 in his 17th season. We genuflect before him once again. 33 years of age now.
Indeed. I have a few thoughts on this.
Yeah.
One is that I think we are clearly seeing the beginning of the end of the Messi era. And he's not the physical force that he was. He can't get away from opponents. And he's still great because the range of his talent is magnificent. But I would imagine that that's going to mean that I can't see Man City being there as an option. And if he does leave Barcelona, I would have thought that trying to get into his shoes, and his boots were probably a little bit smaller than mine, but trying to get into his shoes, I would have thought that if he does leave Barcelona, Paris Saint-Germain would be the place that he'd want to go, because he can coast a little bit, keep himself fresh for what really matters. Mm. Business end of the Champions League and one more crack at the World Cup. Were he to go, for me, the Man City thing now looks, I'm watching him over recent months, it now looks as if it's maybe 2 or 3 years too late for him to put himself through the challenge of the Premier League. I may be wrong. I've been wrong many, many times in the past. But also, I'm wondering how future generations will look back on this. Because there's a tendency now from today's pundits to look at Pelé's competitive goals for Santos and say, well, who were they against? You know, who was that against? You know, it was the São Paulo State Championship. Yeah. Looking from the point of view of the time, Brazilian football wasn't an export industry then. So it had the best Brazilian players, the vast majority of them, were playing in Brazil, with also some very good players from elsewhere in South America. So the level of opposition was much higher than you may think if you're just looking from today's perspective. Mm. Now, let's fast forward 30 or 40 years. The Joe Malloys of the day, they may well be looking back at Messi and saying, yeah, but those goals, I mean, how many of them were scored against Getafe and Levante and so on, you know? Yeah. Because I think by then, I would imagine that the European big clubs will have got their way and they'll have a European Super League. So, you know, there won't be as many of these games of Barcelona against the Getafes of life. I hope, and maybe I'm hoping against hope, that this doesn't happen. This European Super League doesn't happen. And the evidence that I'm bringing to the table here, it has to do with what's happened to Brazilian football. Because Brazil is it's a country the size of a continent. And because of that, the tradition of its football is regional. It's now become national, but it was regional. It grew up as regional. These local state competitions were for decades the main event and taken very, very seriously indeed. Now, what has happened then is a lot of teams have big club status. Just in the south and the southeast, there are 12 giants. That's without the clubs that have considerable support in the northeast of the country. When football becomes national, you see that there aren't enough meaningful titles left for all of these clubs to retain their giant club status. Because if you have 12 big clubs in one league, once someone has to finish 12th. And if you're consistently finishing 12th, are you a big club anymore? Brazilian football is an angry environment for two reasons. Firstly, is that Brazilian society is an angry society, but also because this regional past has generated expectations that cannot be realised once the game is national. Let's bring that one to Europe. So let's have a European Super League. When you start with 20 big clubs. Now, those 20 clubs are big clubs because they win the majority of their games. But once you put them in one league, someone's got to finish 20th, and someone's got to finish 19th, and someone's got to finish 18th. And these clubs will no longer be winning the majority of the games. They'll be losing the majority of their games. So it's a process almost designed to bring about insatisfaction and to concentrate still further the number of big clubs in the world. You know, you might start with 20 big clubs, but looking 10 years down the line of that, you'll only have 5 or 6. And I'm not sure that's a healthy process.
Damn it, Vickery. Brilliant. That is, they're so interesting, those two things. That point about the European clubs and the Messi Pelé parallels. Really interesting. Yeah, even your dog approves.
Yeah. He may disagree. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah,
he's like, stop going on about it. Come here. So who's going to step into the Messi, and I guess let's throw in Ronaldo as well, when they depart, if they're pretty close to that point as a de facto best player in the world?
Well, there's a lot of hope that Neymar can do it. I mean, if he is going to do it, he's not going to be able to do it for anything like as long as the Messi and Ronaldo age. I mean, he's 29 in February. So the big question mark against him, I think, happened in the final of the Champions League, which may be the biggest game that he's ever played for Paris Saint-Germain against Bayern Munich. And what worried me about that game is that from the moment that Bayern took the lead, from the moment that they scored, Neymar's game absolutely collapsed. Mm. He did nothing of note from the point that Bayern Munich scored because he was feeling the pressure of having to step up. He was feeling, I think, the emotional blow of losing. I think there's been a hideous error in his preparation as an athlete in that he hasn't been prepared to lose. I once saw Peckerman, who has coached Argentina and Colombia and made his name as Argentina's youth specialist. He said it's an absolute crime to young players if you don't prepare them for defeats, because it's something that they're going to have to deal with. Mm. So that worried me there. I mean, Neymar is obviously a magnificent player, and he is very popular with his teammates. And Messi loves him. They get on extremely well. So there is the image of him as a spoilt brat. And I think that there are aspects of truth in it, but it's also something of a caricature. I think he's a much better bloke than that. I think he takes his game very, very seriously as well. No one gets that good at anything without loving it and taking it seriously. Mm. But that worries me. You know, he's on limited time. He's got maybe 4 or 5 years at his peak because, you know, someone of that build needs that pace and acceleration to get away from the rival defenders. So he's got 4 or 5 years, and that means that he needs to overcome this thing of losing. And he went to social media afterwards and he said, losing is a part of sport. But that's the difference between social media and reality. You know, you can portray on social media something that you're not. And Neymar had clearly done that in those circumstances because he clearly hasn't learned how to deal with defeat. He's only been on the losing side twice for Brazil in competitive matches. One was the World Cup against the quarterfinal against Belgium. The other I was in the stadium for. It was going back now 5.5 years, the Copa America of 2015 in Chile. They lost 1-0 to Colombia. Carlos Sanchez did a fantastic marking job on him. And at the end of the game, he kind of attacked the ref and picked up a long ban. And it was disheartening for me to see that in this Champions League final, he still hasn't learned to deal with defeat. If he's going to take on that throne, even if it is only for a few years, he must be able to learn to cope with defeat, because without being able to learn to cope with defeat, there are no definitive victories.
Okay, clock's against us. Thanks so much for everything all year. Have a wonderful Christmas, stay safe, and we'll talk to you in the new year, I'm sure. Tim Vickery, thanks so much. Tim,
look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Tim Vickery there, always great to have him on. So Manchester United fans, it's gone very well in the last 10 minutes while we were chatting to Tim there. Cavani scored a brilliant goal with his left foot from outside the area. It was a beautiful finish. And then just to put a cherry on the icing, United have hit Everton on the break, who were obviously pushing for an equaliser. And Martial finishing really, really well, counter-attacking move. And he side-footed it into the far right corner very calmly indeed. So a 2-0 win at Goodison for Manchester United. Full-time whistle is gone.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.